accession number 28495, reel 12.
Albert Hughes, reel 12.
Right, leaving Cairo on the Empire Airways route, C-class flying boat Koorong, the captain was Captain Norris. This was one of the flying boats which took part during the evacuation of Crete. It was a practice to take on soldiers until water came up to the level of the door, then they close the door and take off. They carry up to 50 soldiers at a time. On this flight, there were just 9 Fleet Air Arm pilots. We were the sole occupants. And we took off from the Nile, and the first landing was on the Dead Sea. We went ashore, stretched our legs. I don't know if it was refuelling, perhaps not. But when we went on board again, there was a gentle ripple, and the flying boat was dancing on this ripple, and I was nearly seasick. It was a great relief when it got airborne, and I was soon able to enjoy what they called a packed lunch in Cairo. It was pretty interesting airborne lunch, and probably better than what you get nowadays on Qantas. I certainly enjoyed it. The aircraft was flying about 5,000 feet over the desert on its way in towards Basra. A little bit boring, for after a time I thought, let's liven things up a bit. So I got them all to move slowly, one by one, to the tail of the aircraft, knowing that the captain would be trimming. And then when it settled down, we all rushed forward, and the aircraft went into a gentle dive, and we all went to our seats and pretended to be asleep. And a face came round and from the cabinet and glowered at us and said nothing. So I said, OK, let's try the reverse, the dangerous one. So we all moved forward as far as we could. And then we all rushed back to the tail and the nose went up. And I thought, I wonder if we're going to stall this. It didn't stall, but the pilot had to take some action. And this time the face came round and he said, OK, you so-and-sos, you've made your bloody point. Come and work your passage, you. So we got what we wanted. We could have asked for it, and we never thought. So we took it in turn to go up and fly the thing. It was probably on automatic pilot, but it didn't matter. We were sitting there. It was enjoyable. And we had to land in the middle of the desert. I was looking out for water in the middle of the desert. And one of our pilots had trained on Catalinas. So he was given the honour of landing at Abanya, a big lake in the middle of the desert, which is an RAF base, where we probably refuelled. And then we went on from Habania to land at Basra. I can't remember now whether we landed on the river or a canal. I think probably on the river. And we stayed overnight in Basra in a luxurious hotel. But of course, it wasn't safe to go out. I went onto the pavement and looked around and thought, I'd love to walk around, but it's not safe even then. We were, you know, obviously getting VIP treatment because this is the standard for this particular Empire Airways route. The next day it flew down the Gulf, landing at Bahrain and Sharjah, Diwali and Karachi, where we left the plane, which was then going to go on its way in the direction of Ceylon and so on. Koorong, I was asked by the chairman of our pilots association, what's the name? And I thought, it's a touch of Australia. So I looked at the atlas, and Koorong is a small stretch of coastline south of Australia near Adelaide, and it encloses a huge and enormous lagoon. Do you know this? No. Australia's longest river, River Murray, runs into and forms this lagoon, and this long sand bit, probably formed by sea action, has just left a small outlet for the river to enter the sea. So this is a huge, beautiful, rich in animal and vegetable material. And the word koorong means narrow neck. I discovered that when I was in Australia in August, because I got the leaflets. And it's an apt description. But I prefer to think that when the Aborigines came south, say out of desert country, and saw all this wonderful rich land, they probably said, koorong. I think that's where it came from. Anyway, that's a good story. I had to look it up because my daughter in the junior school, the name of her Australian class was Koorong.
So did you fly on, what, aboard a Dakota for the next section of the journey? Was it, did you?
Well, now, we stayed in Karachi for a couple of days, in tents, and we immediately got the usual tropical lecture by an MO who said, if you get sunburned, report sick, it's self-inflicted injury, it's punishable if you put on a charge. So he said, the best thing to do is to go out and get sunburned. Okay, so we did, in a controlled manner. A Dakota flew us up to Delhi. It was getting hot now. And we spent a couple of days in Delhi. Then a Liberator flew us straight down to Colombo, to Ceylon. And as we were flying over Ceylon, looking down on the jungle, three Corsairs came up, just like sharks, came up and made a formation, flew with us. It was a nice sort of introduction. It was really lovely to see. And then an expedite, they flew us over to Trincomalee for a short time, waiting for the place to be, the next course to be ready for us. And at Trincomalee, I managed to get a first solo on a martinet and a first solo on a wildcat. We tried our best to get the string bag serviceable, and we couldn't get it serviceable. We even paid them money, but they couldn't get it serviceable. I was most disappointed about that. Now, what am I talking about? The string bag.
Swordfish.
The swordfish, yeah. Yeah.
So, what happened when you got to Trincomalee? What was the...
Well, we were only at Trincomalee a few days. Then we were sent over to the other side of the island, HMS Rajalia, which is on the east side of the island, near Puttalam. We had a boozing session before leaving. I'm not a boozer. I was the only one sober. I helped to put the rest to bed. So next morning we were crossing the island on 3-ton trucks. I got a seat with the driver and the luggage and left the other to be sick in the back. And on the way crossing the island, we stayed at a beautiful ancient site full of marvellous ruins. Anuradhapura, I think it is. We just got out to stretch our legs and use the toilet. There's no time to look at all these marvellous ancient statues and things. Just use the toilet. The toilet was a big circle of concrete with a hole in the middle. And that was all it was. Now, of course, we're now back flying Corsairs in a little airfield in the middle of plantations and jungle on one side, just a big circle. Straight away, we're into aerobatics flight drill, and now we're using a camera gun and practicing a dive bombing, angle of dive, 60-degree angle of dive. And camera guns without deflection and camera guns with deflection and curve of pursuit. This is all now operational training. The The thing that really scared us is dive bombing in the Corsair because it goes so fast. We approach at about 7,000 or 8,000 feet, and you roll virtually almost completely inverted before you pull into the dive. And the dive angle is said to be 60, it feels like vertical, but the acceleration and weight is enormous. You've only a few seconds to pick up the target and aim and release the bomb. So it didn't make for very accurate bombing. The first time you drop one bomb, the second time you carry four bombs and you make four drops. The next thing is air-to-ground firing, which I'll describe in more detail. The problem with dive bombing is that my friend Frank Godfrey, doing dive bombing, didn't pull out. He went straight into the ground. And I was in the air in a dog fighting exercise, heard this news. I knew that somebody on dive bombing had hit the deck, and I knew it was Frank Godfrey or another man, another friend. So we broke off our exercise and we flew back. And I parked my aircraft and went to wait for the next man in, and it wasn't Frank Godfrey. And he saw me waiting, and he knew what I was thinking, because I wanted Frank Godfrey. We looked at one another, and we just walked off the airfield. There's nothing to be said. And we went to the place where we had sort of meals at the airfield, and a young chap, just a boy, he climbed up a tree and dropped a couple of coconuts, opened them up and gave us some coconuts, and then made us some tea. And then we just walked back to the billets. You know, there wasn't much to be said. And when I was told officially later, possibly by, it may have been by one of the chaplains, perhaps, I said, okay, I want to go and see the spot. He said, you're joking. I said, no, I want to go and see the spot. I've got imagination. Of course, he wouldn't let us go. So I don't know whether he was ever buried or not. And of course, then I had to get his kit and pack it and write home to his mother. Her husband, a bit of a nasty type, had left her. And I wrote home to his mother and her daughter and told her as best that I could what had happened. And she got the official letter missing, and she clung to this until after the war. She clung to it until she died, which was rather sad in a way. So I didn't find dive bombing particularly easy after that, but I did enjoy low level bombing. We used an old three-ton truck as a target, and we were carrying small smoke bombs. And you could fly low, and if like throwing a dart, you could throw the bomb into the back of the aircraft. It was amazing the precision you could put this bomb in this. Of course, there was no ammunition coming back, you know. It was easy. We all enjoyed this. And the other type of attack, air-to-ground firing, along the beach, so that you're firing out to sea, there were four rows of targets, three targets in four rows, so your four aircraft could do the attack. You do it one solo, and then after that you do it in formation. And you'd fly about 1,000 feet or so you could see the targets. And when you turn towards them, you drop down as low as you could get, for safety, if you like. And then as you got near the target, you'd have to pull up, say, 500 feet in order to get the downward angle. But to pull up and push over was uncomfortable. So most of us would prefer the alternative, which was to roll upside down and pull down and fire like that, and then roll out and fire like that. So we were rolled upside down to fire on the first target. We were rolling out to fire on the second target, and we straight and level to fire on the third target. And then we went straight out to sea at low level as fast as we could, yinking. And we'd take it in turns. Sometimes you'd lead, and sometimes you'd be in the formation. To charge the guns, this was done hydraulically. You'd press the charge button, and the hydraulics would push the first cartridge in to the guns. That's six cartridges. I had the habit of always doing it a second time, the belt and braces, which meant six live rounds were ejected. And sometimes, if you were not the front man, you could see them falling out. It was quite common in this exercise to come back and find holes in the wings, possibly ricochets, which gave me some thought for what might happen later on when you're firing at a ship and the other aircraft are in front of you. I thought of that much later. So this was enjoyable, and we got pretty decent marks on it. We now began to practice formation flying in an operational sense. We were in this so-called finger formation of four aircraft spread out, and do fairly simple exercises. It might be a 180-degree turn, and it would have to be to starboard or port, and you'd have to know which one and think on. And the leader would say, there was a key word for it, and he'd say, he'd announce the key word, starboard, 180, go, and you whip round. The idea was, if somebody's on your tail, this was going to give them a bit of a surprise. So you could either starboard or port, or you could do a 360 and then do it. But it had to be precise. And sometimes we'd have an operation in which you would switch over. So some aircraft would go underneath and some aircraft would go over the top. And you had to know which was which. Because it was all done instantly. And we were also doing high-speed, low-level formation flying over the jungle. And in the afternoon, with the thermals generating, that was bumpy, because morning was nice flying in Ceylon, but every afternoon the thunder clouds would develop. We were also given training with an instructor in Harvard on how to intercept an aircraft, to put yourself into an attacking position. And this was usually done in a cloud system where the target wouldn't deliberately hide, but you could use the cloud to get on its tail. And it meant you were learning to do some very unusual manoeuvres to get onto the tail of the target in the shortest possible time. In fact, the way the fighting developed in the Pacific, none of this was used. The air combat had finished by the time we got there. We had air superiority. It was all ground attacks. So, and that brought us to the training at Puttalam, HMS Rajalaya. We had to go back to Trincomalee to do some more addles on an enormous runway, which made it easy. And then we had to do deck landings, and we went out on an escort carrier in the evening. I haven't got its name because we didn't fly on it. And in the morning, some of our pilots flew the Corsairs out, and we were all standing in the catwalks on each side to watch them fly in. And I positioned myself opposite the barrier. And this first Corsair came in, and it was much too fast. It should have been waved off. The hook was a foot above the deck. It wasn't going to catch a hook. And I waited till the last second, and I thought, well, when he hits that barrier, there's a lot of metal going to be flying around, and all the heads disappeared on mine. And there was a dreadful noise and silence, and we stood up and the deck was empty. He'd ripped out the barrier on the port side, twisted round the propeller, slingshot around the island, tail first, and he jammed between two anti-aircraft guns, stopped him going overboard. And the captain was furious because he just got brand new state-of-the-art gun sights from out from England, and they'd written off, and he couldn't mend the barrier, so we had to put us back ashore again. So there was a short delay while they got another carrier ready, and we went out again in the evening. And in the evening I marched up and down the carrier for some fresh air and just to get a feeling of the size of it, and a man joined me without any uniform, with just casual clothing and no hat, and I chatted, and I said something tactful like, "I hope we do better on this carrier." He was the captain. I discovered later he didn't tell me, he was kind. Well, this time the first aircraft coming out was a Hellcat, which allegedly was easy to land and very, very strong. It made an enormously heavy landing, and the tail unit, the empennage, broke off. So the rest of it bounced over the barrier, not through it, bounced over it, went skating up the deck and overboard, forward, port side, and unfortunately decapitated the seaman as it went. He was in the wrong place. He might have been safe, you know, but he was in the wrong place. Any of us could have been in the wrong place. You never knew where it was going to go. And of course, we all jumped on deck and looked at our stopwatches. It was a long time before he surfaced. He was picked up. There was always a destroyer behind the carrier under flying operation, so he picked up and put on board to tell us the story. He... fortunately, the hood is always open and it stayed locked. His cockpit harness somehow got tangled. He couldn't release it quickly in his panic. He couldn't release the parachute quickly. He had to wriggle out of this and remember to disconnect the various things, the cable. He said when he got out, it was very dull light. He's gone quite a fair depth. And he pulled the lanyard on his life jacket, the Mayweather, the CO2 bottle, inflated, but he'd left the mouthpiece open. So he said, getting to the surface took a long, long time. He had a few lessons to learn. He was lucky to make it. They couldn't mend that. They put us back ashore again. And this time, the HMS Glory, which was a light fleet carrier, was going through, and we went on board and we did our deck landings with no problem. But the HMS Glory was fitted with Seafires and Barracudas, and we looked at these with shock and alarm that they should be going to the Pacific with these outdated aircraft. And while we were watching them deck land, the Seafire did its party trick of catching a wire and tipping forward and chipping its propeller tips on the deck. They used to have to slice a few inches off. We felt we were lucky to be on Corsairs. We'd now finished. I considered I was now on holiday until I got on a carrier. So from Trincomalee, we were flown by they flew us to Colombo to get the long distance flight. So a Liberator flew us from Colombo to the Cocos Islands for refuelling, and we got in the Cocos Islands after dark, and I stood at the Cocos Islands skimming stones in the water, and I think, what a shame, I've nothing better to do here than skim stones, and there's nothing south of me but the Antarctic. I thought, this is an event. However, we made it to Perth and then Perth to Sydney. Now, There's an interesting feature here. Can you switch off for a second? The Japanese took the Cocos Islands for a time, so there's no refueling stop. But they had to keep a connection. So the only aircraft to do it was a Catalina, and with minimum luggage and no more than two passengers initially, and it would have to take off before dawn, cool air, still conditions, and full petrol tanks, and he'd have to make a diversion to keep well away from the Cocos Islands, and he could fly from Ceylon to Perth non-stop, and it took more than 24 hours. They saw the sun rise twice. So everybody who made that trip got the order of the double sunrise. And we were sorry, we were not going to get it. But we didn't. We were a couple of years too late. Even so, the flight in the Liberator was most interesting, except that I was watching the exhausts. The superchargers are driven by the exhaust gases. And they're glowing red hot. I thought it was going to catch fire. And it was not heated. It was a cold trip, that. But probably better than doing it by Qantas nowadays. However, that brings us to Sydney. Okay. We were going to stay at the Sydney Hotel, so as soon as we dropped our luggage at the Sydney Hotel, we had to report to the office. But first of all, as soon as we landed at Sydney, the first thing I saw next to the airport reception buildings was a three-engined aeroplane, Kingford Smith's Southern Cross, the first aircraft to fly the Pacific, standing out in the open. I think they put it in a museum now. I've got a photograph. I was astonished. So we went into the reception and had our first Australian breakfast, and, you know, it was steak with everything. You know what it's like. So we got to the Sydney Hotel, and then we went to the office, and the first thing they said was, would you like your liquor ration? We said, of course, duty free. Of course. So each one of us had been a little chitty, and they told us where the store was, which is only a short walking distance. So we went down to the store and said, we'd like our fortnight's ration. He said, oh, you want it all? Yes, we'll have it all now. And what is the ration? Duty-free ration. Oh, we said a couple of boxes of spirits, a couple of bottles of spirit, a bottle of port or a bottle of sherry, a bottle of each, a large bottle of Australian beer, 14 of those, and Australian wine's not rationed as much as you want duty-free. Well, we just didn't think. We said, OK, we'll have it. Well, these bottles suddenly fill the counter. The rate of us, multiply that by eight, you know, it's a lot of bottles. So we had to get a taxi, put these in the taxi. Two of us went on to ride shotgun, and the rest of us walked in front and behind, and we escorted the taxi to the Sydney Hotel, and across a very wide pavement, a human chain carried all these bottles through the foyer, under the eyes of the very respectable residents, into the lift and up to our rooms. I got a single room. As I said, there were eight of us, so I got a single room. Somebody else must have got, the others are sharing. I didn't even bother to take a bottle into my room because I was still nominally teetotal. Well, by the time this was done, thirsty work, it was nearly lunchtime, so what did we do? We went out for a drink and a lunch. We're not going to spend any time in our bedrooms. And we went out each day for lunch, excellent lunch, and had maybe dinner in the hotel. We hardly had time to go up and have a drink. And we arrived at Sydney on the 20th, and we were told on the 23rd that we would be flying out on the 24th. And they said, reminder, you're still on limited weight flying kit, you know, you're flying. And said, don't worry about the state of your rooms, we'll come and tidy up after you. It was a long time before the penny dropped, and wondered how often they'd played this one. We were not the first or the last. So